Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, Episode 160, Trace Maddox, The Lawyer, the Witch, and the Witness. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Ed Chang from Vanderbilt Law School. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. This week, our guest is Trace Maddox. Trace is an acting assistant professor of lawyering at NYU Law School's lawyering program. In addition to legal writing, he also teaches a reading group on the rise and fall of the criminal trial. His academic interests are in comparative law and legal history, specifically in the area of criminal and constitutional law. Our podcast today features Trace's new article, The Lawyer, the Witch, and the Witness, Witchcraft and the Law of Evidence. It's forthcoming in the Yale Journal of Law and Humanities. In it, Trace takes a detailed look at an unlikely subject, the witchcraft trials in England during the 16th to 18th centuries. Now, most of us, when we think of the witchcraft trials, like the Salem witchcraft trials in Massachusetts, think of mass hysteria and mob violence. But as Trace recounts, this is surprisingly not how those trials ran. As Trace argues, witchcraft, like any other criminal offense back in those days, was the subject of a substantive criminal statute, and the trials featured the same procedural and evidentiary protections as any other crime. Relatedly, English courts worried about and were skeptical of the evidence in these trials. And while undoubtedly hundreds of people were unjustly put to death for witchcraft, these trials also resulted in many acquittals. My discussion with Trace takes us back to the English witchcraft trials, what they were like, and what disturbing implications they might have for our legal system of proof today. Trace, delighted to have you on Excited Utterance. Welcome.
Thank you. Very excited to be here.
Your article, of course, deals with the witchcraft trials in 16th to maybe 18th century England. Fascinating topic, but it's also not, I might say, the most obvious one for someone to choose. So to get us started, can you just tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this topic?
Yes, absolutely. It starts way back. Growing up, I was something of a fantasy nerd, so I was very much into sort of the fictional stories about witches and wizards and that kind of thing. And as I got into college and, you know, into law school, I became more interested in the academic aspects. And then when COVID hit and we were trapped inside for a while, I had the opportunity to read some academic works on the witch trials to kind of expand my understanding of the historical aspects and, I guess, the more factual side of things. And I was reading this book by Edward Peters called The Magician, the Witch, and the Law. And I came across this term, which is crimen exceptum, which is Latin for an exceptional crime or a crime apart. I was in law school at the time, and so this idea of an exceptional crime stood out to me. And I remember flipping through Peter's book. He has a little footnote that just says basically that this idea of crimen exceptum, an exceptional crime, has never been fully studied. As a law student, somebody with the legal background and also the more casual interest in sort of the witch trials, that kind of thing, that stood out to me as a gap in the scholarship that I could fill.
When most of us think about witchcraft trials, we think of, I guess what I would say is a witch hunt, lawlessness, mob violence, maybe at best some kind of kangaroo court. You argue in the article that that's not true, at least with regard to these English trials
from the period. They weren't lawless. They weren't necessarily even a kangaroo court. Can you tell us more about how these trials were in fact conducted?
So they were really conducted in very much the same way as other criminal proceedings at the time, other felony proceedings at the time, which is to say that they typically began with a kind of private accusation. This private accusation by, a villager or a townsperson or someone in the community would get investigated by a justice of the peace, so like a lay magistrate. And from there, if the magistrate determined that there was what we would probably now think of as probable cause, okay, meaning there was just enough evidence to continue on with this case, then the magistrate, the justice of the peace, would bind the person over, meaning they would be sort of held until the next felony session of court. And at that point in time, they would be treated, again, just like any other defendant accused of a felony, which is that they would be brought in front of a grand jury. Rather, they would not be brought in front of a grand jury. The accusers would be brought in front of the grand jury. They would present their evidence. The grand jury would either indict or return no true bill. And that was really probably about a 50-50 shot. The grand jury in this time period was much more robust than the grand jury that we have today. And so a huge number of cases, both witchcraft and otherwise, would never make it past the grand jury. For those cases that did make it past the grand jury, the accused, again, whether it was witchcraft or, more common crimes like theft or murder or whatever it may be, they were then pretty much tried immediately. And so the grand jury would quickly be converted to a petit jury, and the justice of the peace would take on sort of a prosecutorial role. The accusers, they would testify against the defendant, and the defendant would then have the opportunity to cross-examine, to testify on their own behalf, although notably not under oath at the time. So these procedures that transpired once someone was accused of witchcraft were really very difficult to distinguish from the procedures that transpired once someone was accused of theft or murder or infanticide or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and that's the impression that I got was that there was nothing exceptional about these trials. You talk about in your paper that there were substantive criminal statutes about witchcraft. Some of them get repealed, some of them get reinstated. And then it's business as usual, the regular rules of evidence and the regular rules of criminal procedure. It was not mass hysteria or some kind of bloodbath.
That's exactly right. And I think that the important thing that's difficult for us to wrap our minds around now is that these people in the court, in the communities, they absolutely believed that witchcraft was possible, that it happened, that it was common to some degree. And so they weren't suspending disbelief or, simply going through the motions in these trials. They were under the impression and were firmly convinced that this crime at least could be committed. This was a real crime that really did exist. And so to follow the same process in witchcraft as in theft or murder or arson is to investigate one crime just like another, to treat one crime just like another without any special distinction that this one right here, this witchcraft, is an impossible crime or it's a crime that is simply fantastical.
So, what kinds of evidence did we see in these trials? So, you have probably the similar kinds of evidence that you normally do, but then you also have more extraordinary types of evidence that we wouldn't see in a regular courtroom today, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that you are correct that most of the evidence heard in these trials was really pretty mundane. It was typical things like just witness testimony. There were a huge number of confessions, right, that were admitted into evidence. And these were things that could be heard as evidence in any more mundane criminal trial. Some of the more unique things that are more unique to the witch trials that I have called supernatural evidence, to use a modern term, include things like the witch's teat. So there was this idea that witches nursed demons, that they had these familiar spirits, which were these sort of imps or demons that did their bidding for them. And the idea was that these witches would feed these spirits on their own blood. And so in the 17th century in particular, you see this reliance on physical searches of accused witches to see if they have unusual spots on their body where they would supposedly feed these demons with blood. Another example of supernatural evidence would be something that I have termed the prayer test. And the idea behind the prayer test was that because witches had made an infernal pact, they had sold their soul to the devil, there were some holy things that they were incapable of doing, and specifically that they were incapable of properly reciting scripture. And so the test would be to set an accused witch to recite a very common prayer, typically the Lord's Prayer, and to make sure that she was saying this without making any errors. And if she was able to do that, if she was able to recite the prayer correctly, that was seen as strong evidence that she was not a witch. If she kept stumbling, kept making errors, kept making mistakes, that was attributed to this demonic or this infernal pact that she had made and was seen as strong evidence that she was a witch.
And I'm assuming that there were no empirical studies showing the rate of errors with regard to prayers for people who were not witches and people who were witches, right?
That's absolutely correct, but I will say that this sounds utterly ridiculous to us. It sounds like something that anyone, particularly in a moment of pressure, may make this mistake in reciting even something that's very familiar to them. But we do see this concern from the authorities at the time, and the case that stands out to me is actually that of Jane Wyndham, who was the last individual to be convicted of witchcraft in England. She was repeatedly tutored on the Lord's Prayer by the local vicar. He would recite this prayer to her, she would recite it back, and she would make a mistake. He would correct her mistake, try to point out what she had done wrong, and she would again make the same error. And this was done over and over again, at least according to the accounts, right? We have no way of, we don't have recordings of this, of course. But according to the vicar and the witnesses, no matter how many times he corrected her, she would make the same mistake, which rather ominously was to say, deliver us into evil. And so that's not a great, right? That's not a great mistake to be making in the first place. And unfortunately, she made it over and over again, at least according to the reports of the time. And so this wasn't something where if someone stuttered a single time, they were immediately executed. This was something where the courts were looking for an inability to do something that non-criminals, non-witches, should be able to do easily.
I think I was struck not only in the context of the supernatural evidence, but also with the confession and witness testimony that the courts were no fools in this area in some ways, that they knew about the problem of false confessions. They worried about the fact that children were potentially unreliable witnesses. And as you just said, in the case of supernatural evidence, they were worried about whether or not someone just happened to stumble, or whether or not this was actually real evidence. Anything to say about that they were actually quite concerned about the reliability of evidence in ways that perhaps we would not have thought when we were thinking about these kinds of trials.
I would agree with you, and that I guess that's really sort of the secondary point of my paper. It is that not only were the people involved in these criminal processes following the letter of the law, but I think that they were really following the spirit of the law as well, and taking great pains to make sure that they weren't executing people on evidence that they viewed as flimsy. And this reminds me, I had a professor in law school. He would teach comparative law, and sort of his refrain was to always assume that other people are at least as smart as you are. Never assume that just because someone does something differently, they're stupid. And so I think that's sort of the takeaway here is that just because these people believed witchcraft was real, were operating under a separate sort of set of assumptions, doesn't mean that they were entirely foolish, or that they didn't understand sort of the risks of false confessions, false convictions. These were thoughtful, rational people. They were just operating under a different understanding than we do today.
So your findings here, I find actually quite disturbing for a number of reasons. One is this point that you just made. The people who conducted these trials were actually trying to be rational, trying to do a good job. They worried about similar things. They worried about the reliability of confessions and witnesses and the other kinds of evidence that were available at trial. And I worry in some ways about what we do today. How do we know that 200 years from now, our successors will say, well, we as a society did a bunch of really dumb things in convicting a number of people for various crimes as well? In some ways, I'm reminded when we don't have supernatural evidence anymore, obviously, but I'm reminded that Michael Reisinger and his co-authors, in their famous article critiquing handwriting evidence and kickstarting the general critique of forensic science, they actually begin with the supernatural tests for witchcraft. And they say what's going on in forensic science could, in fact, be very similar, right? No empirical basis or problems with empirical basis. Is my parallel apt? Should we be worried about the same or similar problems with the things that we do today?
I think absolutely. I think it's an entirely apt parallel. I think that you are absolutely correct to mention handwriting evidence and sort of the general challenge or general skepticism towards quote unquote forensic evidence. I'm immediately reminded of bite mark evidence, which of course has increasingly come under scrutiny as sort of pseudoscientific. I think that there is a very real possibility that we are relying on evidence in many cases, cases that we think of as mundane today, that will be derided in years to come. I will also push one step further. I think one of the important takeaways from the witch trials is that we now view these individuals as having been convicted of impossible crimes. And I think that there is a very real possibility that in the future, some of the crimes we prosecute today will be seen as impossible. I'm thinking in particular of cybercrimes, maybe of complex forms of financial crimes, things that a jury is rarely going to have physical evidence of, right? They're rarely going to have straightforward testimony from firsthand witnesses. These are crimes for which the evidence would be as baffling to people in the 17th century as the witchcraft evidence is baffling to us today. And that is not to say that people should get away with these, more complex cybercrimes or financial crimes. But I do think that there is an important takeaway regarding this idea that whether a crime is objectively real or not can be quite hard to pin down.
Very interesting. Here's another reason why I find the work disturbing in some ways. You have a properly functioning legal system with all procedural safeguards, and yet, in hindsight, you have clear injustice being done. I think many of us lawyers, in particular these days, we comfort ourselves with process-based solutions. And in many ways, your work shows that process is not the end-all be-all of justice. So is the paper in some ways a wake-up call that our focus should not be on process alone?
So I hope so. I hope it is a wake-up call to that extent. I think that usually, under the traditional narrative, the witch trials are exactly as you've said, presented as this cautionary tale of look what happens when we become hysterical. Look what happens when we set aside rationality. Look what happens when we proceed on bare assumptions and let our fears get the better of us. And what I've tried to do in this article is to show that there is a cautionary tale here. There is something scary going on. But the cautionary tale isn't that traditional story of look what happens when we get hysterical. The cautionary tale is, in fact, look at the kinds of injustices that can be done when we proceed following the standard rules, when we proceed with good faith understanding, and when we proceed with the best of intentions. What do we do about that? How do we know when we are making those kinds of errors? That's another question. But I do hope that, as you said, it can be something of a wake-up call.
Final question for you. What's next for you, either on this project or perhaps with other scholarly projects?
So I am currently working on something fairly far removed from the early modern witch trials. I'm currently working on a comparative look at plea bargaining. I'm actually a comparativist by training originally. And so I am taking a look at the ways in which criminal cases are adjudicated in France, in England, and then here in the United States. And that is my current project. Will I revisit the witch trials? I would like to think so. I think there's still a lot of interesting things to be done in that area, but I don't have any clear plans at the moment.
Well, Trace, thanks for being on the podcast today to talk about an esoteric but nonetheless fascinating topic. Great having you on the show.
Thank you.
As I mentioned during the interview, Trace's historical account of English witchcraft trials left me more disturbed than ever before. Bad enough that hundreds of people were put to death in England for a crime that they didn't commit, indeed, that they couldn't commit. But now, we can't even chalk it up to mass public hysteria, a sort of now we know better narrative. Instead, what you see were courts applying all of the procedural protections of the time. They were thoughtful about the reliability of confessions and witnesses and other evidence, and still they managed to generate farcical results. And as I said to Trace, we as evidence scholars often take heart in process. The substantive truth is hard to figure out, and so it's the process that we trust to make adjudication fair. But ultimately, and here maybe I'm just stating this a bit too strongly, but it seems that it's not process that is justice, but accuracy. Process is only a means to the end of accuracy. And while we lawyers might find solace in process, perhaps we're just fooling ourselves. That leaves the difficult question of what we should do with the admonition that Trace's work gives us. And maybe the answer is just this: making sure that the proper procedures are followed is only the first level of ensuring a fair and just judicial system. At the second level, we need to make sure that those procedures have empirical validity. To say that we have a long-standing procedure that has been followed is simply not enough. We need to dig deeper and ask if that procedure is actually working. Later this season, Lisa Kern Griffin from Duke, in many ways, takes Trace's article's admonition to heart. She asks if cross-examination, which some might say has been fetishized by the modern confrontation clause, whether cross-examination is all that we hope it to be. But that's for another episode. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The associate producer is Alex Nunn, and the production editor is Anirudh Morella. Additional production assistance has been provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle Greer Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Ed Chang, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another new work in the world of evidence and proof.